I'm Tom.
And I'm Chris.
And this is Room for Innocence.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Chris. What's up?
Good to see you. It's been a while.
Yeah. What happened? We just got busy, I guess.
We just got busy. Yeah, I haven't been able to do the editing.
It's so much work
in such a timely manner, but I'm working on it.
I was listening to another podcast and they were talking about, and I started picking up that they have like several podcasts and they're like, this is an episode.
It was probably Small Town Murder.
It might have been them, because they had another one too. And right. I think even the prosecutors were like, they had a separate thing. And I'm like, right. How do you guys do like more than one and have a life? Because I believe the prosecutors work full time as prosecutors. I work full time as an attorney. And I find it challenging to do anything, you know, I mean, oh, my goodness.
I know it is hard to find the time. And anyway, I start editing episodes and I'm just like, oh, my gosh, we say so much that I have to take out. And it takes a long time. Anyway, not complaining, doing this for fun, and it's good. But for anyone who's like, I wish you were still putting out weekly episodes, we may get back there and we'll see. We're trying.
Yep. And speaking of that, anybody who's listening and has any feedback or episodes that you want to listen to or just anything that you want to say, I personally, and I'm sure Chris as well, would love to hear it.
We get some really interesting emails from people. With emails or Facebook messages or whatever, with case ideas or personal experiences that people are going through with the legal system, and it's really fascinating. So yeah, definitely reach out and share your stories. Today,
or if you just want to send fan mail and say how much you like me, that's really what I'm going for.
Yeah, we'll take that.
I want to hear about me.
Little stoking of the ego to keep you going. So today we're talking about a very famous case. We are going to talk about the origin of Miranda rights.
Okay, excellent.
You have the right to remain silent.
You do. Miranda versus Arizona, if I'm not mistaken. I have not read this case in a long, 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 long time. But yeah, it comes up quite a bit. And a lot of times when I'll be talking to a client and they will say, they didn't read me Miranda rights. And my first question is, well, did you say anything to the police? And they'll say no. And a lot of people, which leads me to this statement, which is a lot of people really don't know what Miranda rights are. They don't know. They don't know Miranda was a person. They don't know where it came from, what happened before that then, and what it actually means. Mm-hmm. So tell us, Chris, tell us about it. Tell me about it.
So for starters, you've mentioned on this show before that in order to defend everyone's rights, you have to defend everyone's rights. It's one of my favorite quotes of yours. Meaning, do you want to remind us what that means?
You have to defend, for lack of a, you know, just not to get lost in words, but you have to defend guilty people in order to defend the rights of the innocent as well.
Excellent.
You can't come up with case law and you can't litigate a case on a violation of a search and seizure law unless somebody actually was searched potentially illegally and something illegal was found, like somebody reaches in your pocket and finds crack. You know, that's how you end up coming up with a case where you can fight it and create law. If the cop reaches in your pocket and finds nothing, there's no case. It never makes it anywhere. So somebody has to break the law somewhere, allegedly, if you will, in order to create these issues that we fight. And by doing so, we protect everybody.
Right. And if somebody is illegally searched and nothing is found, they don't make it to trial, and therefore there's nothing to contest So
correct.
It's only going to be for the person where the, like you said, where the contraband was found. Mm-hmm. That's the only one that you're going to be able to appeal. And so the innocent folks are not going to lead to much of this type of thing. It's going to be the guilty.
Exactly.
People.
And you know, you think about all the people out there who get profiled for whatever reason, searched, their car is pulled over. You know, young man embarrassed on a date night because he's getting searched and he's got nothing. And then the cop says, okay, well, you can go. And he leaves. And, you know, what does that do to a person? And there's a bunch of reasons why these things are bad, why we fight for them.
Yeah. So in this case, you know, we'll tell you from the very beginning, Miranda, he's a bad dude. This is not a wrongful conviction. This is not, trying to say this guy was innocent and he was railroaded. No, I mean, this is a bad dude, but in his journey through the justice system, something wasn't done right. And it got taken all the way up to the Supreme Court so that this could benefit everyone else in the future. So it's just interesting to know that going in. All right. So we'll start by talking about the crime that led to Miranda entering the criminal justice system. Before we get started, let me just talk about some sources used for this research. First, obviously, the Wikipedia page for Miranda v. Arizona has a nice summary of the order of events. There's also, let me quickly make sure this article is what I think it is. Nope, it isn't. Okay. There's also a short documentary, a 25-minute documentary on annbergclassroom.org. We'll put the link in our show notes. And the documentary, I watched it and it was informative as well. And then there's an article on crimelibrary.org by Mark Gribben called Miranda versus Arizona, The Crime That Changed American Justice. It is a long article. It's like 10 pages long. And
that's a lot of reading.
Yeah, very detailed. And a lot of this comes from that article. All right. So I'll start by talking about the crime that led to Miranda entering the criminal justice system in this case that ended up going to the Supreme Court. Okay. On March 2nd, 1963, an 18-year-old young woman who we will call Patty was making her way home late at night from her job at a movie theater in downtown Phoenix, Arizona.
This doesn't sound good.
Mm-mm. It was after 11 o'clock at night. As she walked down the street, a car stopped a block in front of her and a man got out of the car. Patty kept walking, and as she passed the man, he grabbed her, threw her in the back of the car, and bound her hands and ankles.
Yeah, that's just so crazy because, you know, when things like that happen, you know, you want to be like scared, but you can't be scared of everything. You know, guy pulls up, gets out of the car, you know, you don't want to just go running and fleeing.
I think if I were walking down the street after 11 o'clock at night and a guy stopped his car in front of me and got out of the car, it's a block in front of her, right? So it's pretty far in front. It's not like he, you know, screeched to a halt in front of her, but I would be very, very cautious.
Sure.
But then again, it's not 1963 and I read a lot of true crime.
Yeah, it's true. You know, I mean, it's tough. I mean, I guess, you know, cross the street, remain vigilant, try not to stay too close. But if you just, you know, if you just keep looking at every single person as if they're going to be somebody who's going to do something terrible to you, A, your brain will just implode and B, you just won't get anywhere, you know, especially like walking around downtown here where I live. I mean, there's crazy dudes all over the place. I mean, I'd be back and forth across the street like a ping pong trying to get from one place to the other. So it's just, it's sad how these things just happen. Bam.
It's really sad. It's really sad. And yeah, I mean, you can't live your life in fear. Like you said, I love that. You just won't get anywhere.
Yeah.
You're constantly rerouting yourself to get around everything.
But remain vigilant and listen to that little voice in your head. You know, if some say, hey, this isn't right, cross the street, go the other way, you know. Yep.
And I think there was a bit of, you know, in reading about this, a little bit of not wanting to seem rude, you know, not wanting to seem like you're profiling the guy. Right. So you're like, I'm not going to. So anyway, she gets thrown in the back of the car. The man drives for about 20 minutes, stops in the desert, rapes Patty, and then drives her back and drops her off about a half mile from her home. So Patty reports the incident to police, but police suspected her report was fraudulent due to vague or inconsistent details.
Oh my God. Yeah. 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 I mean, you're talking about the dark ages of, you know, rape litigation.
Pretty awful. And the way that she was treated was pretty awful. I think they really, really interrogated her and called into question every inconsistency. Like the route that she said he drove was impossible. And it's like, are you serious? This woman was bound and stuck in the back of the car. And you're criticizing the fact that that she didn't get the route correct.
Yeah, and just fucking raped. I mean, obviously the most traumatic situation you could be in.
Thinking you might be killed. I mean, it's unbelievable. So it turns out also that Patty had some intellectual delays. She was 18, but apparently had the mental capacity or the intellectual ability of like a 13-year-old.
Oh, so these cops are even bigger dicks then.
But they didn't know. They didn't know that. And apparently after someone in the family informed them of that, they kind of decided to take a closer look at her case. But they were about to close her case, thinking that it was fraudulent. And I mean, essentially, Patty solved her own case. So she had taken note of details about the car. And a few days after the kidnapping and assault, Patty and her brother noticed a car that looked like the one her attacker had driven. So they reported the make and model of the car to police, along with a partial plate. Police tracked the car and found that it was registered to a woman named Twyla Hoffman. When police went to Twyla's home, she was there with her common-law husband, Ernesto Miranda, who matched Patty's description of her attacker.
Interesting. Do we know what her description was?
I believe it was fairly tall, you know, about 6 feet tall, lanky, dark hair, possibly Hispanic, maybe Italian, did not have an accent.
That's a pretty good description. I mean,
had a mustache. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of guys who are going to fit that. But then B, when you just take this random, you're like, oh, go check out who owns his car, and a guy matches that. That's pretty good, you know?
Yeah. I'm sure when he walked up to the door, they were like, cha-ching.
Yeah.
So, putting your 1963 police hat on, they took one look at this guy and knew it was him, right?
Guilty.
Yeah, totally. Okay. So that was the crime. Now we'll move on to the confession. Ernesto Miranda was born in Mesa, Arizona on March 9th, 1941. By eighth grade, he had been in trouble with the law. And in ninth grade, he was arrested and convicted of burglary and sent to a reform school, the Arizona State Industrial School for Boys. By age 18, Miranda had faced additional charges of sex offenses and armed robbery. So what did he do? He joined the Army. In the Army, Miranda was charged with AWOL and voyeurism. And after 15 months of service, he was dishonorably discharged. He spent time in jail in Texas, Tennessee, and even federal prison in Ohio and California.
Wow. So he just was in a life of crime.
Yes. So now Miranda is 22 years old, and police are at his door saying they want to talk to him about a kidnapping and rape, and suggesting they talk at the station rather than in front of his family.
Okay.
Oh, we don't want to have this conversation in front of your wife and kids.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they just want to get him downtown, right? I mean, they don't give a fuck about his family.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They want to question Miranda in their interrogation room in a setting that gives police a significant advantage over the accused.
It's a perfect, it sounds gentlemanly though. Let's do this downtown so we don't upset the wife and kid. Yeah.
At the station.
This is important. Did they invite him down or did they, the question, well, we don't know the answer just yet, but the question is going to be, was he forced to go down or did he feel like he didn't have to be there? You know, was he coerced? You know, was this a custodial interrogation which was about to take place or was he just down there? Did they just say, hey, come on down? And you go, okay. And then they ask you questions and you barf it up. But you didn't have to be there and you could have left at any time. Those kind of questions can have a lot to do with at least today's view of how these riots work. So sounds like they just asked him to come down.
Yeah. I don't know the exact answer to that. I've seen it written in some of these sources that he was not free to leave, but they hadn't necessarily told him that. But that if he had said, I'm out of here, they would have officially arrested him.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
Well, and that, you know, as we know that this is what happens is they say, well, let's not arrest him because if we arrest him, you know, the process has changed. So let's just talk to him. But the reality is they are interrogating the person as a suspect. And in some cases, that person is not free to go. I think a lot of times, someone who's being questioned by the police, they don't even know if they're free to go until they ask.
Yeah.
And which is fascinating. They'll sit there for hours and hours and hours. And if they just said that they wanted to leave, they could.
And you know, my thought generally is that those are the guilty people because you're trying to please somebody. If you straight up didn't do something, you're like, I got to go, man.
Yeah, I got stuff to do, right? Like, ask me your questions and then I'm out of here.
But yeah, like, if you're like, when you're being interrogated and you did something, once people start talking, and I've watched, you know, as people may pick up, I mean, I'm a criminal defense attorney for thousands and thousands of cases. And I've watched so many interviews with detectives. And it's a science now. There's actually techniques that they have and we could talk about that for forever. It's tough. Like the only way to win an interrogation is to not speak. Once you start talking, and this is for the guilty mind. If you didn't do something, then I guess in theory, you have nothing to worry about. My advice, don't talk to the police, even if you didn't do anything, get an attorney or get out of there. But if you did something, once you start talking, you can't stop talking because you're trying to talk your way out of it. And the police know that you're trying to talk your way out of it. And they'll let you talk about stuff. And then you just can't stop. And you just start getting just diarrhea of the mouth. And it just never ends. And that's why these people sit there for hours and hours and hours. Because they're like, well, maybe if I'm just good, maybe if I just tell this cop what he wants to hear and I act like I'm friendly, he'll let me go. They're not going to let you go, you know? And what I always tell people is like, if they're going to arrest you, they're going to arrest you. And if they're going to arrest you and you, whether or not you talk, then they're going to arrest you, whether or not you talk. If they're not going to arrest you, unless you say something, then don't say anything. So just don't say anything because if they're going to arrest you anyway, they're going to arrest you. And if they're not going to arrest you, don't say anything. Don't give them a reason to do it. I've seen plenty of cases where they don't have it. They don't have what they need. They start talking to people. And they end up getting it. And then it's over. If they've handled what is now the Miranda procedure, which didn't exist back then.
And if, you know, we all know, if you don't know, now you know that the police can lie to you. They can tell you they have stuff they don't have.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They can.
So they'll tell you, we have it on video. We have witnesses. We have fingerprints. We have DNA. And then you're like, oh, well, I might as well fess up. You know, if you fess up now, you'll come out of this better. And so people will say things and the police never had any of that.
Yeah. And a lot of times, they do have stuff and they let you talk your way into a hole knowing that you're lying. And then they wait till you've said a whole bunch of lies. Then they spring the fact that they know about these lies. Then your brain totally implodes. And the long and short of it is, if you did something wrong and you're trying to talk your way out of it with the police, there's almost no chance you're going to be able to do it. Just because they're literally trained on how to deal with you. The hardest part about lying is remembering the lie. You're just not going to be able to do it.
That's again part of why they wanted him at the station. This is where they do their best work.
Mm-hmm.
How they walk in and out of the room, how they leave you alone and come back, like all of that is part of their formula. So, okay. So they get to the station and they put Miranda in a lineup with three other Mexican Americans from the jail. And they bring Patty in to look at them. And she looks at them and she points out Miranda and says, "That looks like him, but I can't be sure that it is him." And that is not a positive identification.
No.
So after the lineup, Miranda asks how he did. And Detective Carol Cooley says, "Not good, Ernie." I don't know if that's a direct quote, but I see a lot of references that he said, "Not good, Ernie," which I think is funny.
Not good, Ernie. Get him on a first name basis.
Here. Yeah. Good. Yeah. We're tight now.
Here to help you, Ernie.
So they go to the interrogation room and they start questioning Miranda. They do not inform him of his right to remain silent or his right to have an attorney present for questioning. Later, Detective Cooley would state that he figured Miranda knew his rights since his rap sheet was so long. This wasn't his first rodeo, as they say.
These guys.
He's like, the man's been through this so many times, like he doesn't know what his rights are.
Yeah, you can't assume stuff. These guys, I'm telling you, this guy's been in and out of prison forever, and they don't know a fucking thing. Like, I literally sometimes I'm even say to my clients, I'm like, you've been doing this forever. Everyone in your family's been doing this forever, and you still have no idea what's going on.
And you haven't gotten any better at it.
And you're still here.
During the interrogation, police were able to get a confession from Miranda. So he admits to what he did verbally. And Patty is still at the station. And they had brought her to the interrogation room, not inside, but outside the interrogation room, so that she could listen because she wanted to hear the voice and see if she could identify Miranda by his voice. So detectives point Patty out to Miranda and ask if she was the girl that he raped. And he replied, "That's the girl." So he's now confessed and said it was indeed Patty. At this point, detectives ask Miranda to write out his confession. He did so on a form that stated, "I do hereby swear that I make this statement voluntarily and of my own free will, with no threats, coercion, or promise of immunity, and with full knowledge of my legal rights, understanding any statement I make may be used against me." And Detective Cooley says he also read that statement out loud to Miranda and that Miranda agreed to that statement. So there's a few things. He was not informed of these rights before being questioned and before giving the initial confession. So by now he's confessed. I mean, what is he going to do now? Now all he's doing is formalizing it by writing it out.
Right.
But he was not read his rights before all of the questioning that led to the confession. And then the other thing is signing a form that says you're aware of your legal rights doesn't mean too much if you don't know what you don't know.
Right. Exactly. And I can think of just a bunch of cases I have where I've watched the police do this. And what they'll do is they'll give the client a form and they'll say, read the first line. And the first line says something like, "I understand that I have the following rights under the United States Constitution." And they go, "Okay, great." So they determined that you can read. And then the police go ahead and read you your rights and they read you your Miranda rights, you know, and then they have you sign a form. So it's similar to what he signed, but instead of saying, "I understand my rights," it says, "These are the rights."
These are the rights. Exactly. So he's not informed of what the rights are. He says, "Yeah, I understand my legal rights." I mean, who knows what he thinks that means?
Nobody knows. That's the thing. People laugh and they're like, "Oh, you should know." You don't know. you what rights you have. It's very important. And as much of a douchebag as we may think Miranda is, I mean, this is so incredibly important because people do not know what rights they have. They just don't. Basic elementary rights. The they right to remain have, silent.
I mean, now we know.
Because it's on TV.
It's on TV. Now we know you have a right to remain silent. You have a right to an attorney. But people don't know when they have that right, like when that right starts. And they also don't know, they get the vibe that exercising that right will put them in a worse position.
Yeah, they do. If you ask for an attorney, the cops will be like, well, we could just settle this now. And, you know, but ask for an attorney, ask if you're free to leave. Those are the big questions. You know, if the cop says you're not free to leave, then you know you're in trouble. And then don't say anything because you ain't going anywhere. They're going to arrest you anyway. And if, like I've already said, if you're not free to leave and they have enough evidence to arrest you, then they're going to arrest you or they're going to end up letting you go. The only thing talking to them can really do is it's not going to convince them to let you go. The only thing it can really do is provide more evidence to hold you in.
Yeah, it builds their case.
It's very, very difficult. It's like when you get pulled over for a DUI. And if I was going to have 1,000 DUI cases presented to me, I would want each and every one of my defendants to have refused to speak to the cop. Don't admit to having any drinks. Don't take any field sobriety exercises. Don't take a breathalyzer. Now, in some of those cases, the cop's going to arrest you anyway because you're just so obviously drunk, but it leaves the state with very little evidence to prosecute. And out of those 1,000 cases, you'll be able to get a bunch of them dismissed and you'll be able to work out wonderful deals for most of them. You know, some people are going to have a bad result just because they were so obviously drunk. Mm-hmm. Those people would have a probably even worse result or the same if they took the field sobriety exercises and if they took the breathalyzer. But the other people whose cases are marginal, maybe they are drunk, but it's marginal. The evidence isn't great. You don't give the state extra evidence, your case is going to work out. The reason I'm saying all this is when the blue lights come on behind your car and you're pulled over and you're on the side of the road and you're alone and you're talking to a cop and he's asking you these questions and you know good and damn well you had 3 shots of tequila and then you might have over a 0.08, you know, you want to answer truthfully. Yes, I had a drink. You know, you people want to do these things. They want, because most of the time the cops are really nice. Come on, you know, let's just do this. And you, will you submit to field sobriety exercises so we can clear this up here? Yeah. And you do these things. It's very hard. This is the takeaway. It's very difficult to look at the police officer and say, I'm not going to do this, because you run the risk of getting arrested. And if you get arrested, though, you can just bond out. And the case a lot of times will end up getting dropped. I'm talking out of those 1,000 cases, if everybody refused to do all of that, all of those exercises, a lot of the cases wouldn't even get filed. But it's very, very difficult to assert yourself when you're talking to a cop. And the only people who are going to do that are people who know other attorneys who have told them, hey, don't take the breathalyzer. Don't take the field sobriety exercises. For God's sake, don't admit that maybe you had one drink. These are people who have been told what to do by people who know what to do. Nobody's going to be able to come up with it on their own. But even if you know your rights, it's very difficult and scary to assert them. And if you don't know your rights, it's just a really sad, terrible situation. And the other thing is, not to go down the rabbit hole, but then you have false confessions. You don't even have to talk to the police. You'll have innocent people talk. Remember what I said about talking to the cops? Once you start talking, you can't stop. And these police will get you to make a false confession. That's how confusing these situations can get. You have the right to not speak, and it's people just don't realize it. They certainly didn't realize it back then in the 60s and before.
Did you ever see Goonies, where the kid like starts telling the Italian family like all of the bad things he's ever done in his life?
No, I did see Goonies, but it was in the movie theater. So he
just can't stop. He's like, and then,
oh God, no.
Okay. So I want to kind of focus in on one of the things you said there about people not knowing their rights or whether they can assert them. So in 1963, the, you know, T TV was less prevalent. Obviously, there was not internet. There was no Law and Order. The only people who were aware of their constitutional rights were people with money, because they had attorneys on retainer who informed them how to behave.
Yeah. The only people who knew the rights are lawyers and people with lawyers.
And people with education who had studied constitutional law. If people didn't have a background in law or didn't have a ton of money, they didn't actually even know about these rights. They really were not well known. And they certainly were not well known by indigent people who had been, you know, in and out of trouble, or people who English wasn't their first language, immigrants, you know, anyone without money. They were just completely clueless. And so they were the most vulnerable populations were the ones that didn't know how to protect themselves legally.
Now this case, am I getting my years mixed up? But this came out a few years after Gideon, I think.
It was after Gideon.
Yes. So, and then Gideon, you know, landmark case. That was that our first episode of podcasting we did? It was either the first or second.
Gideon was our first episode.
Go listen to Gideon, because Gideon kind of, you know, goes along with some of this. But Gideon's what gives people the right to have an attorney. And, you know,
specifically during a trial. Gideon established that you have a right to an attorney in a criminal trial. And I'll get to that in a minute, because every time the Supreme Court makes a decision, these decisions are very limited in scope.
True. Yeah.
And it leaves a lot of questions open as to where else these things apply. All right. So for the trial, Ernesto Miranda was assigned 73-year-old lawyer Alvin Moore. Moore had added his name to the list of court-appointed lawyers only 1 month earlier. His initial defense strategy was an insanity plea. And there is a lot of, there is a strong belief that Miranda did have significant mental issues, because he did have so much sexual deviance, you know, that he wasn't just a bad person, but that he had, some mental issue. I'm nothing close to a psychiatrist, and I won't speculate any farther than that. But
okay. An
insanity plea was not
far-fetched.
Yes, thank you. That's what I was looking for. It was not far-fetched. Miranda met with psychiatrists who determined that he was fit to stand trial, was able to assist in his own defense, and understood the charges against him. They found that he was, quote, mentally abnormal, end quote. But an insanity defense didn't seem like a good strategy at this point. The best defense at this point would be claiming the confession was coerced and should be inadmissible. Trial was set for June 1963, 3 months after the attack.
Wow. Okay.
I mean, the speed of the courts back then.
And you know, I could, and that'll even happen here, but it gets continued. Nobody bats an eyelash.
Right.
Because
for years.
3 months is not enough time.
The witnesses for the prosecution were Patty's sister, Officers Cooley and Young, and Miranda's written confession was the sole item entered into evidence. No witnesses were presented on Ernesto's behalf. So the only evidence was the written confession. There was nothing to substantiate it, like fingerprints. They didn't have DNA, but they had, you know, various typing, because there was semen. And it's just surprising to me that there was no kind of analysis done to substantiate Miranda being the offender. When Detective Cooley took the stand and the written confession was being entered into evidence, defense attorney Moore objected. Cooley acknowledged that he had not warned Miranda of his rights before questioning him. He said he had read the paragraph out loud to him, the one where Miranda acknowledges that he is voluntarily giving the statement and that he understands his legal rights. But Cooley acknowledged that he did not inform Miranda of what those rights are.
Okay. Well, it's nice that that he had acknowledged that instead of cleaning it up and being like, oh yeah, I told him all about it.
Right. Moore said the confession should be inadmissible and cited Gideon versus Wainwright, a Supreme Court decision that said all defendants should be allowed counsel during a trial, even if they can't afford an attorney. Gideon, however, did not say anything about being allowed counsel during questioning. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the judge, Yale McFate, allowed the confession into evidence.
Well, he sounds like a fancy judge.
I mean, if your name is Yale.
Parents had dreams for you.
The jury returned a verdict quickly, finding Ernesto Miranda guilty of rape and kidnapping. And Miranda was sentenced to 20 to 30 years on each charge to be served concurrently.
You can't hate on the jury for that. You've confessed, for God's sake. I mean, that's the evidence anyway. You know?
They were given that evidence. It's not up to them whether it was coerced.
Yeah. I mean, they're just going to get the thing and be like, where does it say guilty? Where do I sign? I mean,
right.
You know, I mean, I like to think that you would, you know, give it a second thought, but really, how long is that going to take? You know?
Yeah.
That's an open and shut trial. You'd have to be the worst prosecutor in the world to lose a trial like that.
Right. And he's guilty. They knew it.
And he did it anyway.
They looked at the evidence and they had no doubt that he was guilty. Following Miranda's conviction, Alvin Moore appealed the case to the Arizona Supreme Court. He felt McFate had erred by allowing the confession into evidence.
Good.
18 months later, the Arizona Supreme Court decided that Miranda's confession was admissible and his conviction stood.
Because the cop says, I didn't tell him his rights. You know, how did they come up with that?
I don't think it had been established that they had to.
Well, you know what's funny is if they had said, okay, we agree and overturned it, good for Miranda, but it would have not gone to the Supreme Court.
True.
And who knows how long it would have been until it got established. So it goes back to like, you know, these terrible things need to happen. And it's a shame that he had to suffer more, but.
Yeah. Let me say, I love that point that if Arizona had overturned it, it wouldn't have gone to the Supreme Court, because I think Arizona did the right thing here. They said, based on current law and, you know, based on the current rules, a rule wasn't broken. There's no rule that says the police have to inform you of your rights. And I think Arizona did the right thing by saying, we don't have anything to overturn this on. And then, you know, it's up to someone else to say, should there be such a rule? Okay, they based their ruling on a recent U.S. Supreme Court case, Escobedo versus Illinois, where the court ruled that when police are no longer conducting a general inquiry into an unsolved crime, but are focusing on a particular suspect in custody, refusing to allow that suspect to consult with an attorney, and failing to warn the suspect of his right to remain silent, is denial of the assistance of counsel in violation of the Sixth Amendment. So let me break that down a little bit. The decision in Escobedo versus Illinois seemed to indicate that a multitude of requirements had to be met for it to apply. The suspect had to be, you know, a particular suspect that the police were focusing on, not just one of many suspects that were being brought in for questioning. The suspect had to be refused the ability to consult with an attorney, and the suspect was not warned of the right to remain silent and to have assistance of counsel. The Arizona Supreme Court felt that Escobedo did not apply here because they said that since Miranda had not requested an attorney, he had not been refused the right to have one. Because the way that decision had been written said that they had to, it said, if a suspect, if the police refused to allow the suspect to consult with an attorney. And so there was a lot of confusion nationwide about the Escobedo decision, exactly where the lines were to be drawn regarding the right to counsel. And there were a lot of cases being appealed and writs of certiorari being sent to the Supreme Court asking for clarification on Escobedo.
Interesting. So if you don't know that you have the right to an attorney, so you're supposed to ask for an attorney without knowing you have the right to an attorney.
Yeah. You had to be denied one in order to say that the police had violated your rights.
Yeah, but how do you know to even ask for one if you don't know that you have the right to one?
Right.
I mean, I guess you just ask for everything. You should know better.
What rights do I have that I have not yet asserted?
Yes. Tell me what. Yes. I mean, that's a good question. What rights do I have, sir? Oh,
where,
wow.
Where was I? One of the parties to get involved in this, you know, trying to clarify the Escobedo decision was the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU. The ACLU wanted to support taking Miranda's case to the U.S. Supreme Court. Defense attorney Alvin Moore declined to participate any further due to failing health. He had been 73 when he took Miranda's case, so he was just not in a position to take it any further. The ACLU found a new attorney to represent Miranda, John Flynn, a reputable criminal defense attorney with one of Phoenix's largest law firms, Lewis, Rocha, Scoville, Beauchamps, and Linton.
Mm.
This would be one of two cases the firm would accept pro bono for the ACLU that year. And Flynn would be assisted by his partner, John Frank. So you have John Flynn and John Frank. Not at all confusing.
No.
In bringing the case to the U.S. Supreme Court, Flynn and Frank had to decide which part of the Bill of Rights they would focus on. Miranda's case hinged on either his Fifth Amendment right to avoid being compelled to incriminate himself or his Sixth Amendment right to the assistance of counsel.
Why can't they do both?
That's a great question, and one that I'm not probably educated enough to answer, but I think it had to do with when you bring something to the Supreme Court, you just want to bring them a very focused question to answer. And if it's too broad, you know, they're just not going to take your case.
Yeah.
So they chose the Sixth Amendment right to the assistance of counsel, arguing that the protections of the Sixth Amendment are not available to those persons so unaware of their rights or so intimidated that they do not request the guiding hand of counsel at this crucial stage. So you have a right to an attorney, but if you're unaware of that right, then you might as well not have it. I just said that like so whiny. I mean, no, God.
I thought it was well said.
The question to be decided was whether police should be required to inform someone of their right to counsel prior to questioning them, or if they could assume that the person knows their rights.
Well, I just think that answers itself. You
know,
especially
what I mean? In 1963.
Yeah, but it's, you know, you have to bring it. You have to make things clear. Can we just assume? I mean, don't we know better? I hear the word assume and I'm like, really, you know?
Honestly, the guy's been arrested 25 times. Can we assume he knows his rights? No, you can't.
You can't. They might have just assumed you knew him the second time he got arrested and never gone over him since.
The Supreme Court was inundated by requests to clarify aspects of Escobedo, and they agreed to hear the Miranda case.
It's interesting how the Supreme Court works. At least back then, I was reading, the book, Gideon's Trumpet. Good read. Well written.
But if you don't have time to read it, just go listen to our first episode on Gideon v. Wainwright.
Forget about the book. Just listen to our podcast. But it talks about just the you know, you've got the Supreme Court justices, but there's an army of clerks and assistants below them going through all this stuff, reading all these motions. Some of them are nonsense. Some aren't. Some are legitimate. Some are legitimate, but they're just pipe dreams. And some just don't fit into the agenda that could potentially go forward. And some just luckily wind up the one that gets in there. And it's like a heat, you know, that they keep going through one heat after the other, and it gets whittled down. You've got fewer and fewer. And Miranda just made it all the way through. It's fascinating, the process of how these cases come before the Supreme Court and how the Supreme Court decides what they're going to do. And just that abstract level of, like, I'm going to say like playing God, but what I mean is just like, it must be difficult to have the potential to listen to and make decisions on so many things and just cast some things aside because they just don't fit the agenda.
Knowing that somebody could spend their life in jail.
Yeah.
In prison.
And this one went forward, and it's just amazing that it did.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, though, the process of how these cases get there. Not every case that deserves to be in front of the Supreme Court actually gets there. There's plenty of cases that are Supreme Court worthy questions of law that just never, you know, are they just not the right piece for the right puzzle at the right time, and they just never get anywhere, and the clerks just put them off on the shelf and nothing happens with them.
And this one is equally interesting in terms of how it ended up being heard by the Supreme Court. And I didn't note the details on it, but there were so many requests to clarify Escobedo that this staff that you're referring to was going through all of them and trying to figure out which ones would best encapsulate or best allow the Supreme Court to make the right clarifications.
And these people are all brilliant that work for the Supreme Court because they're reading it on a high level.
Right. And then apparently there was some just luck involved with where it fell in the alphabet. Like, I don't know if they go by state, and Arizona started with an A, but they said there was some aspect of Miranda just got picked based on the order. And what was the other thing I was going to say? Oh, also the brief that Flynn and Frank wrote was very short. I want to say it was like 4 pages long or something, which probably helped. You know, they were very, very focused in what they brought.
Man, I'm telling you probably have some of these with preambles that people are just they're not even going to read it. They read 2 pages and you haven't got to the point, and they're like, fuck this. Like, I'm not even reading this. And the point gets lost in the mix. And these guys boiled it down. Every word on that petition was probably gold.
Yep. All right. Frank and Flynn argued that under the Sixth Amendment, an accused has the right to counsel every step of the way through the proceedings against him, beginning with the interrogation, and that the police should be required to ensure the accused is fully aware of this right. If police don't inform the accused of their right to counsel, then the right will only be enjoyed by those with sufficient money or education to make them aware of it, thereby clearly disadvantaging those who most need the help. The state of Arizona argued that police simply should not make calculated effort to deny someone their right to counsel, but that the Constitution doesn't require them to proactively inform the accused of this right. Of course they argue that.
I know, but it's like, once it gets to this point, can't we just agree it's probably better to just say, hey, you have the right to a lawyer? Because what you're saying otherwise is, but then we can't take advantage of people, you know,
right?
You know, unless they ask. So,
On June 13th, 1966, the Supreme Court issued a 5-4 decision in Miranda's favor that overturned his conviction and remanded his case back to Arizona for retrial. The decision required law enforcement to ensure that detainees have been briefed on and understand their constitutional rights, and the prosecution may not use any statements stemming from questioning by law enforcement after a person has been taken into custody or otherwise deprived of their freedom of action in any significant way, if the person is not informed of these rights. So the decision, just to summarize that statement, the decision says that if the person was questioned without being informed of their rights, their statements cannot be used.
Right.
Warren stated, quote, the person in custody must, prior to interrogation, be clearly informed that he has the right to remain silent and that anything he says will be used against him in court. He must be clearly informed that he has the right to consult with a lawyer and to have the lawyer with him during interrogation, and that if he is indigent, a lawyer will be appointed to represent him, end quote. He literally wrote the Miranda rights into that is like so the decision. Cool.
You hear about the Warren Court, and he just really came up with a lot of amazing decisions. He was a great Supreme Court justice. I remember all the way back, even when we lived in Seattle, which would be in the early 70s, probably right around the time you were born. Well, I don't know if you want to delete the dates there, but my point is, I remember,
for the record, I never lived in Seattle, so it was before I was born.
Okay, yeah, maybe so. So this was 75 or before, and I remember watching television, and I remember the Miranda rights. You know, the police would. It's something I remember. It's one of the first. You know, I remember we're talking. I'm 3-4, and police on the TV fiction arrest someone and they read them their rights. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. I mean, that's just what was on TV. I remember listening to that on police shows the same way as I remember listening to Scooby-Doo on the cartoons. Mm-hmm. It's as elementary as Scooby-Doo. And me watching that would have been less than 10 years after it came out. So it just hit the scene and became mainstream to the point where it just became a part of just almost pop culture. I mean, part of being a police officer is reading people their Miranda rights when they're arrested. Nobody doesn't know, at least on the general surface level, what their Miranda rights are. People still misinterpret them and don't completely understand how to use them or when they actually apply.
And don't feel like they're truly free to use them.
Yes.
To assert their rights.
You just need to ask the cops, am I free to leave? And if they say no, shut your mouth, ask for an attorney. Because they're either going to let you go or they're not. And talking ain't going to help. Go on though. I am done with my rant.
I did read that right after this decision came out, the TV show Dragnet immediately incorporated Miranda rights.
Sure.
And so on Dragnet, the police would say, you have a right to remain, you're under arrest. You have a right to remain silent. You know?
Yeah. I mean, and you know, that did a lot though, because that alone educates people to some extent. I'm telling you though, it's almost laughable in a sad way how people know these rights and don't exert them. I've read so many cases of my own where I'm reading the police report.
Don't
think
assert them.
Do not assert your murder.
You said exert them.
Assert is what I meant to say. And I'm reading a case. And I'm like, this is silly. Like, I can beat this case. Oh my God, I can beat this case. Why? How did this guy even get arrested? And then at the very end, he's like, yeah, that crack was mine. And it's like, God damn it, dude. Like,
you would have been fine.
You would have been okay. And then, you know, the case gets on my desk and they're like, you need to suppress my statement. And I'm like, bro, like, why did you make it? You know?
Yep.
And that's post Miranda. They've already been read Miranda. And they're like, yeah, I'll talk to you. That crack was mine. And you're just like, oh my God.
My attorney will fix this. Dissenting justices accused the majority of overreacting to the problem of coercive interrogations and anticipated a drastic effect. They believed that once warned, suspects would always demand attorneys and deny the police the ability to gain confessions.
Wow.
Miranda's conviction was overturned, and the state of Arizona chose to retry him without the conviction as evidence. In the second trial, Miranda's common law wife, Twyla Hoffman, testified against him, saying that he had confessed to her.
Hey, baby, guess what I did tonight? Yeah.
Yeah, I think after a jailhouse confession. So I guess I think after he had been convicted, he told her, yeah, I did it, but I'm going to get out of it because of this confession thing.
Gosh, I wonder if you could keep that out because that's all post, you know, that wouldn't have been testified to. He wouldn't have said that if he hadn't already been convicted, and he wouldn't have been convicted if he hadn't given his statement. It seems like that. I mean, I don't know.
Okay, maybe it was before he was convicted, but it was from jail.
Yeah.
It still feels like hearsay. I can't. And you have mentioned that there are many exceptions to hearsay, but that still feels like he told her that he did it. And she's saying he told me he did it. That doesn't feel like strong evidence to me.
It's evidence and it's admissible, though. The defendant's incriminating statements are typically allowed in.
To someone else, to a friend.
To anybody. Now, to your wife, that's there's a marriage exception, which almost never comes in. I've never actually had to use it. But if you tell your wife something, you did something illegal, I believe you can keep that out.
I think the wife cannot be compelled to testify against you.
That's what it is.
But they can choose to. And she was, Twyla Hoffman was like, when do I take the stand? She wanted to testify against him. Miranda was again convicted and sentenced to 20 to 30 years in prison.
He tried.
For the rape and kidnapping of Patty. Miranda was released on parole in December 1972.
Oh my God. See, that's the old days.
So it's almost 10 years after the attack.
Yeah, they keep you in now.
So that makes sense, right? On a 20-year sentence that he would be paroled after 10?
I guess. I mean, I'm in Florida and they got rid of parole for the most part.
People serve full sentences?
85% is about as much as...
No kidding.
About the least amount you can count on.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, that's interesting.
Florida's rough.
Well, he got out in less than 10 years. To make money, Miranda charged people $1.50 for signing Miranda warning cards. He sold.
How cool is that? How much could you get for one of those now?
I wonder.
Oh my God.
And then 3 years later, in January of 1976, Miranda was killed in a bar fight over some spare change.
Oh my God.
He was 35 years old.
Whew, what a sad life.
Start to finish. It kind of reminds me of Gideon.
Yes.
When we were like, you know, Gideon was released from prison and then he died.
Yeah. I thought about Gideon a few times. The difference with Gideon, if I'm remembering correctly, he never hurt anybody. He was never violent. You know,
he was just a petty thief.
Yeah. He drank. And,
a drifter.
You know, yeah.
He was a sad sack.
Mm-hmm.
But he knew that he needed an attorney. He was so bright in that way. Nobody told him that. Oh, gosh. Go back and listen to Gideon. If you haven't listened to our first episode, the sound is terrible. It was our first episode, so
it's a good one though. I actually listened to that myself recently, yeah. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed listening to it. It's a good
great case. It's a great case. Okay. Data from the FBI Uniform Crime Reports shows a sharp reduction in the clearance rate of violent and property crimes after Miranda. However, according to other studies from the 1960s and 1970s, contrary to popular belief, Miranda had little, if any, effect on detectives' ability to solve crimes. So given that this show is the defense perspective, when I hear that the FBI says there's been a reduction in the clearance rate of crimes, part of me is like, well, good, because these clearance rates were probably unfair and the wrong people being convicted of this stuff. So the reduction is probably the fact that, yeah, police aren't able to beat confessions out of people. I'm sorry, I should have said coerce, not beat.
Well, I mean,
my bad.
There was a lot of that going on.
Yeah, there was in the 60s. I want to end with this from Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black. In an interview shortly after the Miranda decision, Justice Black was asked, "Mr. Justice, do you think that these decisions have made it more difficult for the police to combat crime?" And he answered, "Certainly. Why shouldn't it? What were they written for? Why did they write the Bill of Rights? They practically all relate to the way cases shall be tried. And in fact, they all of them make it more difficult to convict people of crime." So Hugo Black unapologetically recognized that the framers of the Constitution wanted it to be difficult for the government to deprive people of their liberty.
Or certainly not easy. You know, absolutely. Good for him. I like that. I like Justice Black.
Yeah, I love it. I was not expecting him to say, "Certainly. Why shouldn't it? Why shouldn't it be more difficult?" I was like, oh my gosh. It's an interesting take. Yeah. You know, that yeah. it should be difficult for someone to be deprived of their liberty. We have to be sure. It was very important to the framers of the Constitution to protect people's liberty. And that's the case of Ernesto Miranda versus the state of Arizona and the origin of you being read your Miranda rights when you are taken into police custody.
Yeah, it's great stuff. And then that is another thing. And when are you in police custody? Because what they will still do is they'll be like, "Hey, come on down to the station." They'll keep you in the station, like we talked about earlier, back and forth, keeping you in the room. You're not asserting your rights. You're afraid to say anything. And they'll keep coming in and breaking your balls. And unless you look at them and say, "I want a lawyer," or whatever, like if you're allowed to leave, then it's not a custodial interrogation and they don't have to read you your Miranda rights at that point, because you don't have the right to a lawyer because you're just a dude that they're talking to. It's a consensual conversation. And I'm not trying to teach people how to get away with crimes, but just ask the police, "Am I free to leave? Why don't you come with us? Do I have to?" You know, a cop stops you on the street. You know, "Hey, can I talk to you? Am I free to leave?" It's all you need to, "Am I free to leave?" It's all you need to remember how to say. And that's the whole, like, have you seen the guy who's like, I don't answer questions. Look that up. I don't answer questions. It can be really funny. You'll get cops that just get fatuzzed because they don't know what to say. "What's your name?" "I don't answer questions." Yeah. Do you know why I pulled you over? "I don't answer questions." And it originated, there was an old guy got pulled over and cops like, "Give me your license and registration." And he gives him his license and registration. And the police ask him a bunch of questions. "You know why I pulled you over?" "I don't answer questions." You know, everything he asks the man, "I don't answer questions." And finally the cop does what he does and lets the guy go. But it went viral and it's very interesting. It's not going to work for you in some cases. You're immediately turning the cops against you. So another part of my advice is yes or no, sir. You know, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. That'll get you out of a lot of trouble, even if you deserve to be in trouble. You know, if you pull the whole "I don't answer questions" thing, it can be difficult, but it can also stymie the police as well. But Am I free to leave? That's your golden question right there. Am I free to leave? I'm just saying, if you don't want to talk to the police, ask them if you're free to leave. And you can, you never have to talk to the cops ever. Like never. You never, ever have to, ever. And they can never make you. That's another thing to just remember. Just don't do it. And for God's sake, if you did it, keep your mouth shut and talk to your attorney, or you're just a dumbass and you're going to probably go to jail.
All right.
Yeah.
On that note.
Yep.
We'll wrap it up for today.
Sounds good. All right. I'm Tom.
And I'm Chris.
And the defense rests.